My presentation is about the Windows Azure platform, architecting, re-architecting for the Windows Azure platform. My name is Kurt Kleis. I work for Microsoft as a technology solution professional. This means I'm not a sales, I'm a solution professional, because I've seen in the invite that my title was specified incorrect. It was like technical sales and something. I'm a technical solution professional. So I have a technical background. I've been working with architectures, projects, and a lot of customers. And now I'm also doing this for the Azure platform. So in this presentation, I will tell you the story about how to architect on Azure and also about how to re-architect, because this is one of the questions people have. Can we put our existing web applications just as is on the cloud? Do we need to do something? Do we need to change the architecture? Well, it depends. But most time, the answer is, yes, we will need to do something. If you want to make use of all the functionality of Azure, then we should change something. Just a quick question. Who is already, just first question, who never heard about Azure? Okay, that's okay. Who is already working with Azure, developing, deploying? I see some familiar faces. Who is thinking about it? Who is looking for knowledge, looking for guidance, and start thinking about a future project? Okay. I think this session is for the last people, people that are thinking about moving to the cloud, moving to Azure. Do we need to change something? I will give you the answer. So first, let's have a quick overlook of what is Azure. What are the components? Well, we have three main components. Windows Azure, the name itself, reappears in one of the components. Windows Azure is a hosting environment. But it's more than just a hosting environment. It is a scalable, load-balanced hosting environment where we have compute power. We can run applications. We can run background processes. We have storage, nearly unlimited flat file storage that we can use simply in the cloud. And we have some management tools. Visual Studio is one of them to build our applications. We have a management portal to deploy applications, scale out applications, add more instances, change the configuration of our storage environment. So this is a web-based interface to manage your web applications. SQL Azure is a database that you rent on a monthly basis for an amount of gigabytes of storage. It's not a physical machine. You don't see the machine. You don't have to administer the machine. You just get SQL as a service. Basically, you get a connection string. The developer gets a connection string to a database, and he can create a schema on it, and he can put the data on it. And our applications on compute, Windows Azure, can use the database, or we can use a database from on-premises. So is it the same protocol that we're speaking? Our existing applications can talk to the SQL Azure in the cloud. Third part is Windows Azure App Fabric. And App Fabric is a name that we use for more than one technology. It's in Dutch, we call it a kapstok, where we can add more and more technologies in the future. Right now, we have two or three technologies: Service Bus, Access Control. Service Bus is there for creating a kind of service bus system where applications can hook themselves to the service bus, provision themselves to the service bus, and they can communicate through a kind of bus system. We can have a broadcasting scenario where one application can publish some data, and other applications that are also connected to the hub, to the bus, can receive the data in a one-to-many relationship. Access Control, Windows Azure App Fabric Access Control, is the technology to create a federated identity architecture. In a federated identity solution, we will see that we will no longer keep our users managed inside our applications, but the management of the users, and like for instance the password policies, will be managed outside our application. So with Access Control, I can have an application that I offer as a software as a service model to my customers, but the users of my applications are people inside the Active Directory of that customer. And they are under the management of the policies inside the company. And we're working with claims. There is a different set of methodologies to allow the communication, to allow the authentication. It's a claims-based authentication model. So that's what we use access control services for. So this was an overview of Azure. So now to the question, do you need to re-architect if you want to make use of that? Well, if you want to use all the benefits of Azure, and let's take a moment to see all the benefits of a cloud platform of Azure is scalability. We can simply add more power, more instances, more data storage, more databases, very easy without investing in hardware and so on. And it's elastic. It can go up and it can go down. Azure offers also a service level agreement, a very high available service level agreement. We allow that your application is running so many uptime and it will never go down. Well, that's one of the assets of Azure, of course. Reduce costs, and because you're in control of costs, you can reduce the costs. And we offer a very cheap hosting environment, very cheap storage. If you compare that to an on-premises investment, it is really very cheap. Mass storage, you never run out of disk space on Azure. And in Azure, we also offer a programming model to deploy an asynchronously architecture, where an application just really quickly answers the requests of the end user, but postpones the process in a background process, like a workflow in the background that can talk to other services while your application is quickly responding to end user user interface. So if you want to use all the benefits, I think really, yes, we need to re-architect. Because the platform is offering the scalability, the platform is offering the mass storage, but our applications, the software that we write, the code, the solution architecture, needs to adapt to that. It needs to be aware of the fact that it is running on a scalable environment. But even if the benefits that we just discussed are not really important, and this would mean you're just looking for a hosting platform, and Azure is also by itself a hosting platform with some added features, but even if you're just looking for a hosting platform, yes, there are some issues that we have to know. One of the most important is for Azure, applications should be as close as possible to stateless. I will explain why. And also to avoid some exceptions and failures that we can see because we're running on a public multi-tenant platform, we need to take in account that we can have failures. And we need to write some additional code, deploy some additional patterns in our application to avoid the failures. So basically, yes. Azure Basics, again, like I said, well, the applications are load balanced. If you deploy an application, your web application, it is running in a virtual machine, but you can decide how many instances of the virtual machine that you want. 1, 2, 100? It's possible. And there is a load balancer that knows the public URL of that application, and if somebody browses to that public URL, it will be load balanced. No sticky sessions, no server affinity, because you're running in a multi-instance environment. Azure is a public platform as a service. And because it's public, some of the resources are shared. We have this big data center, and in the data center we have a lot of hardware. The hardware has a lot of processors, and we're running multiple customers, possibly on the same hardware. You get a dedicated processor for your virtual machine, but again, then you're sharing maybe the physical machine or maybe the trunk, the bandwidth, the network connectivity. You have a guarantee, it's specified in the service level agreement, that you have a guarantee uptime and so on, but you're still working on a shared environment. It's a platform, it delivers some building blocks that are very generic to implement your solution. So as an architect, you have to select what parts of the building blocks that you want to use to assemble them together to one solution. Azure Compute is a scale-out environment. Scale-out means we're going to add more instances of the same power instead of adding more power to one instance. The other one is called scale-up. In a traditional data center, we will see that if we want to have more power, we will add more memory to the machine. We will add another disk to the machine. We add another processor to the machine. That's a scale-up environment. On-premises, we typically do that. In the cloud on Azure, it's a scale-out system. Every machine has the same power. It's a virtual machine. And you can ask for more of the instances. You can ask for more virtual machines. Well, it's not always that we have the same power. You can make the decision between virtual machines having 1, 2, 4, or 8 processors. And if you decide, well, I need 4 processors, then you can have this multiplied by so many instances. So then you're scaling out. Azure is an OPEX environment. OPEX means operational expenses. You don't invest upfront in hardware and licenses. No, you don't. You only pay for what you use at the end of the month. It's operational expenses. There is a billing system that monitors what you use, the bandwidth, the number of hours you run a CPU, the capacity of your database. This is monitored, and you will be billed based on what you consume. It can be high, can be low, depending on the usage of your application. So this also means the code or the design patterns you architect can influence how much you need to pay. I will make this clear in some example later. So those were the basics. Now let's have a quick word about Azure Compute Service Level Agreement. This is a code snippet. No, it's not a code snippet. It's just a text snippet out of the Service Level Agreement document. It's a public document. You can download that from the Azure.com website. And here we specify that if you deploy 2 or more instances, we have an external connectivity of at least 99.95%. And there is another parameter, 99.9%. But I want to stress 2 or more instances. If you decide on having only one instance, there is no service level agreement. Because if the hardware that is running your virtual machine is failing, we cannot reboot it within the service level agreement. We can only do that if you have 2 instances. The chance that both of them go down is very small. So we will put your virtual machines, if you decide to have 2 of them, on different hardware, in different racks, under different power supplies, to have a very high service level agreement. Okay? Well, this is an important fact that we need to know. Even as an architect, we need to have 2 instances. Yes? All right. Let's have a look at the solution architecture. What do we have in Azure as building parts? Web roles and worker roles. Web roles are web-facing applications, web pages, or WCF services. Worker roles are background processes. They are not visible on the internet. There is no user interface. They just do their work in the background. We can call this a service, combination of some web roles and worker roles. We also have storage. Storage is separated from your virtual machine. It's also like a service, storage as a service. If you don't have virtual machines because you do not want to run applications, you can use storage. And you can access the storage from on-premise or maybe from another cloud environment, no problem. So 2 separate worlds, services, and storage. Inside the storage, we have queues, tables, and blobs. Blobs are large files. Tables are like a combination of records. And queues are a first-in, first-out system where you put some message in a queue, and some other part of your application, some other layer of your application will read something from the queue, and inside the queue there will be a message indicating what is the process that you need to start with some additional data. So queues are there to build an asynchronously architecture. And we can postpone the jobs to the worker role, and the worker role will do that in the background. He will read queues and act on that. And then we have SQL data. SQL Azure. We have 1 or more SQL databases. For every subscription, you have 1 SQL server, and you can have up to 150 SQL databases. The SQL databases can be accessed from the internet, from your local on-premises applications, from your services, whatever you want. So the load balancer. The load balancer, like I said, well, this is some system that sits between the internet and your application running on multiple instances. And the load balancer will do this. If a second request comes in, and that can be from the same user in the same browser, it is possible that that second request in your web page is going to be rendered, executed by another instance. And maybe a third page inside the same session could potentially be executed by instance number 3. It's a round-robin system. It's not a round-robin system on the level of DNS, but inside the load balancer, we also think about a round-robin system. It's a round-robin system that has, as a result, there is no sticky sessions. The load balancer doesn't know anything about sessions. So this means if you start the session in instance 1, if you add some data to your session variables, and in the second page, if you are running on the second instance, you don't have access to that session anymore because the session is coupled to the memory of the virtual machine, and you could be running on another different machine from the same session. So this is something that results in we should be stateless. Avoid to use session variables. If you have an application that is already existing and it heavily uses session variables, we need to do something. If you're deploying, creating a new application, you're starting from scratch, try to avoid session variables. But there are solutions. We can store the state that we otherwise would store in a session variable. We can store it in the ESP.NET view state. This means we bring it to the client in the browser, and every request the browser brings the state back to the service. This results in more bandwidth, and more bandwidth also results in more money that you need to pay at the end of the month, because you pay for the bandwidth. So you see, architecture can also influence the monthly cost at the end of the month, because you're deciding on having bandwidth, you're deciding on having a view state, then you also have more bandwidth needed. And sometimes we're not compatible with the MVC pattern. So storing it in the view state is not really a good option. We can store the state in a SQL Azure. It's up to our application that he's reading the state time and time again for every request from a SQL database. This is a normal behavior. This is a normal pattern that we see in also in a multi-farm on-premises web application. We see this, that we store state in SQL Azure. We can also redirect the session state if we still want to use our applications working with session variables, maybe old existing applications. We can redirect, and this is simply a matter of configuration. We can redirect that to SQL Azure. We can also use Azure Storage for that. Or we can use another technology, which is part of AppFabric, caching. Caching is specially made to solve this type of problems. Instead of putting something in memory of one of the virtual machines, we put it in some other memory that is shared by all the virtual machines. Every virtual machine can have access to AppFabric caching environment. And we can configure that our ASP.NET state must be redirected to that caching environment. Working for a load balancer also means there is no server affinity. It's not very useful to write data to a local file system. Because again, the second request can come up to another instance, and you're working on another virtual machine, so it means you have another local file system. So you need to change your applications that instead of writing to the local file system, you write to Azure Storage, because the Azure Storage is somewhere next to your virtual machines. Every virtual machine has access to the storage. So you put your data that you want to write over there, like images. If you have an application that allows the end user to upload an image, well, you store it on Azure Storage. You could also use Azure Blob Drives. And an Azure Blob Drive is a very large blob that you put on Azure Storage. And this blob is formatted as an NTFS system and mounted to your virtual machine. But this only works in a single instance setup. So a blob drive, well, it can be mounted to one instance. The other instance can also mount it. It can also see that blob drive and put some data on it, but only for reading. Yeah? If you combine that with the fact that we need two instances to achieve a service level agreement, this could potentially, again, be a discussion. Do we need two instances? Yes. Well, we have a problem with blob drives. If you don't want to use the blob drives for this issue, Azure Storage is also a good option. Azure Storage can be used from multiple instances, but Azure Blob Drives is a single instance technology. So again, this means think about as an architecture, you need to have a service level agreement for two instances. It changes your way of thinking about the architecture of the application. Scaling. One of the important parts in Azure is we offer a scalable system. But let me make clear, it doesn't scale by itself. It's not I put an application on Azure, and if I have 100 million users, it will scale by itself. No, it doesn't. We offer some APIs, some functionality to do the scaling, but to trigger the scaling, meaning adding more instances, is a decision you make. It is a decision that is influenced by your architecture, because every type of application has other parameters to do the scaling. Maybe you want to scale on bandwidth. Maybe you have an application that doesn't consume a lot of memory, doesn't consume a lot of CPU, but consumes a lot of bandwidth. Well, then you need to scale on terms of bandwidth. If you're running out of bandwidth, then you need to add more instances, because for every new instance, you get some more bandwidth. Let's say another application doesn't consume a lot of bandwidth, but consumes a lot of processing power. You're doing heavy calculations. Well, then you have to monitor a performance indicator indicating the percentage of use of your CPU, and you scale out based on that parameter. So it's simply not possible to create a very generic scaling solution. You need to build your own scaling environment. You need to know what are the parameters that I find useful for my type of application to scale out. So you build a scaling engine. Let's say my application is running on two instances. And the scaling engine will define the metrics, the performance indicators, bandwidth, disk space, available disk space, available memory, utilization of your processor, size of your database, a lot of different parameters. And then you will define polling intervals and see the results. You will see a list of numbers indicating how well your system is behaving. And you will load that into a database, and then you will change the configuration. Okay, this looks really complicated, but this is something where we have guidance on that to help you implement that. So changing the configuration means I'm going to change the number of instances indicated here, count equals 3. If you change it, well, then we will add more applications, add more instances of your application. At the moment you change that configuration based on your scaling algorithm, based on the parameters that you find useful to do the scaling, you simply change the configuration. This is done by, like, for instance, System Center Operation Manager can do that. You can write your own application to do that. You can just do that manually. We will change the configuration, and then we will add more instances. And the load balancer is notified that suddenly we're running on 3 instead of 2 instances. So you see, this is also influencing maybe your operation management architecture. It's not about your solution architecture, but it changes your operations, and it changes how you monitor your applications. And you need to be aware of the fact that there is no generic solution for scaling. You need to build your own algorithm to do the scaling. So this leads me to the unit of scale pattern. We have a lot of design patterns. Well, one unit of scale pattern could also be considered as a design pattern. And this means scaling should be done in combinations of something, in units. Unit of scale is a combination of components in multiple layers. This means I have a UI, I have some process, I have some background process, I have a data access layer, I have a SQL database with some stored procedures and so on. I have multiple layers. I have to decide what is the combination that can be considered as one unit of scale. Yes. For example, well, adding more instances without adding more databases could potentially be a problem. And because you scale out a lot of instances, maybe you say, well, my application, let's scale out to 500 instances. But if you only have one database, you have 500 machines that are hitting your database. So you're just moving the bottleneck from the application layer to your database layer. So you have to think, well, do we need more databases if we add more instances? Again, this should not necessarily be a one-to-one relationship, but you should know how many instances a database can handle, and also how many instances a database can handle, and add them if you need them. You should consider all mechanics that have differing scaling behavior. A queuing also have a kind of scaling behavior. It has a threshold on performance. Your storage has also a different scaling mechanisms. The IO of your blob drives, the bandwidth. So you really have to think about what is fitting together, what can I see as one unit of scale? And if I want to add more power to this, I need to add more power to something which is related in the same combination. This is something you really need to think about. Let's talk about scaling storage. Storage is not about SQL Azure, it's just about Azure Storage. It's not a relational database environment, it's just a flat file environment. And we support to have tables in that. Tables are defined by a table schema. It's not a SQL database, it's just some flat file, but the table schema is owned by your application. It is a C# or a VB.NET class which is defining the schema of your table. And we have huge capacity for that. 100 terabytes, if you want 100 terabytes, go ahead. We have 100 terabyte maximum capacity of a storage account. But you can have up to 5 storage accounts for one subscription. If you're not satisfied with that, you have more subscriptions, no problem. So if we have these very, very huge tables, where we have 100 terabytes for one table, for instance, we need to partition our tables. And partitioning our tables will allow that Azure will move the hot partitions to separate nodes, again, to achieve the service level agreement. So for the performance on storage and the uptime on storage, we again have a service level agreement. Yeah, and we will take action to do something to really achieve that service level agreement. We will look at the hot partitions. You need to partition your data. And then we look at what partition of your data is queried a lot. What part of the data is really very hot that you want to make available very high. Yes. And we will move those partitions. We will move the data across the data center to make the performance as good as before, even if you have a high peak load. But this means you need to scale your applications, you need to scale your storage, and you have to think about some elements. If you look at how we define a storage table, every storage table has a partition key and a row key, a timestamp, and then some fields. Partition key and row keys together, they are unique. But partition key is really the key to allow the partitioning. What we do is, let's look at this example. We have 3 records here, but you can imagine if you have 100 terabytes to spare, you have billions of records. And inside those records, we have A1 to 3, A1 to 4, B1 to 3. So I have 3 different records, but they are defined in 2 partitions. We will put partition A on a different storage node than partition B. If needed, if they are queried a lot, if there are hot partitions, we will move them to separate machines to achieve the service level agreement. So this means you really have to think about how to work with the partitions. Let's say I have a database with all the cities in the world. I've tested it with 7.5 million records. And let's say my partition is the first letter of the city. So this means I have 26 partitions, but they are not equally divided. Most of the city starts with S, and only a small of them start with X. So this is very good way to have a high performance if I know the city and I want to read the information from that city. Let's say the city is Brussels. Well, then I say, well, my partition key is B. So then he only has to scan that partition. He doesn't have to look to other partitions because you're indicating Brussels starts with a B. Well, I'm only looking in that partition. But this is not a good solution if you want to have a query across multiple first letters of city. If I want to make a list of all the cities in Belgium, and Belgium is somewhere a field which is not part of my partition, the system has to look all the partitions to make a combination of all the cities in Belgium. Okay, if I want to select all the cities in Belgium, maybe I will have another partition scheme. Let's say I will do a partition scheme based on country code, and then I have a totally different partitioning schema. You will see country code US. United States has a lot of cities. But here I see VA, Vatican. There are only a few cities in the country Vatican. Yeah? So this is a different partitioning scheme. If I now want to select all the cities from a certain country, this is a very good partitioning schema. because it really knows, well, this is the partition that I have to scan, and I get my information. But now, on the other hand, if I want to have access to data based on a city, let's say Brussels, and I don't specify that Brussels is in Belgium, again, he has to scan all the tables, all the partitions, partition by partition. So these are two opposites, of course, but it just shows you, you need to think about your partition schema if you want to have very large databases. It's not a database, it's just a table, but if you want to have a huge amount of data, you really should think about how to partition. And this is something you do as a developer, or maybe as a software architect. Next is, let's talk about SQL Azure. We talked about scaling, we talked about storage. SQL Azure is our database. What we see here is SQL Azure is running on a shared environment. We can run multiple databases from different customers on one same machine. There is a service level agreement, but we can run on multiple users on the same physical machine. So this means there is a kind of throttling mechanism. You don't want to be influenced by a bad behaving query of another user. If another customer of Microsoft in his application is creating a very bad query that consumes a lot of CPU, and it's another customer, it's not you, you do not want to be influenced by this bad behavior of another customer. So we throttle. We have some technology inside a SQL Server that you will not be influenced by the bad behavior of another customer. So this works in both directions, of course. So throttling means that a connection to a SQL can be dropped for only a few seconds, and we will redirect you to another machine. Because in SQL Azure, every data that you store is stored on three physical machines somewhere in the data center. And there is one primary and there are two secondaries. And if you have access to the database, well, you're working with the primary. But if that primary is running on a machine that is bad query from another customer is influencing the CPU of that machine, we will detect that. We will close your connection for only a few seconds, maybe milliseconds, and then we will move you to another machine because your data is already there. We replicate on two other physical machines. And if you see problems on the primary, we will just redirect you. You don't have to do that, but we will redirect you based on the connection string to that other machine where the bad behaving query of the other customer is not present. But this means for a few milliseconds, for a few seconds, you could lose the connection. Yeah? So the solution is, before starting a command, a SQL statement to a database, you should check if the connection is still open, and you do a reopen in the case that SQL Azure should have closed it. So this kind of pattern that you will see, a using statement that will say, well, I'm using a reliable SQL connection with a connection string, and for every execution of a SQL, I do a open. I will open with a kind of retry policy, I will open my database. The chance that you will have this throttling is very, very low, but it is there to protect you from a total failure, and we will just move you to another machine, and in that move, maybe a few milliseconds, you will lose the connection. It will not happen very often, but your code needs to be aware of that. Well, if it happens, you don't want to fail on that. So you need to take into account that sometimes you will lose the connection. Very, very small chance that you do. But please understand why we drop that connection. We drop the connection because we're just moving you to another machine. Because on the first machine, maybe some bad customer is creating a very large query that will bring you down your application. Instead of bringing your application down, we will just move you to another SQL database. But make sure your application knows about that pattern. And you should have that retry logic inside your application. Azure queues. I'm talking about a lot of different technologies because my main message here is, yes, you need to re-architect. You need to be aware that we're doing some concepts that you need to know in your application. Azure queues, again, another technology. What is Azure queuing doing? It's a combination, it's a communication between web role and worker role. Worker role is a background process, a web role is the front end, and we can put some messages in a queue, and some worker role in the background can pick up the queue. Let's say we have three instances of our web role and three instances of our worker role. Maybe two of them of our worker role are busy doing something, and one of them is free. And the one which is free will do a get message. It will read something from the message queue, and then it will also become busy. But maybe at the same time, maybe a few milliseconds later, the other instances will become free and also get a message from the queue. So it's also a kind of load balancing system. You put a lot of data inside the queue, and you distribute them across multiple instances. If an instance is free, it will read something and become busy. If an instance is busy, at the end of the process, it will become free, and it will read the message again, and so on and so on. So this is the way that queues are working. You put something in the queue, and somebody will read it and execute something. Well, if you want to work with queues, you need to program against an API. Programmers need the API, and that API is part of the storage client library, and where we have this getMessage API. Well, there are two versions, getMessage and getMessage 32, or a number between 1 and 32. The difference is, if I do a getMessage, I will only get one message from the queue. And I got one message, and then I can start to execute it. And only at the end of my process, I can really start getting another message. Maybe in the meanwhile, some other instances of the same worker role will have also read some messages, but I can also only process one message at a time. The second option is, and this is a decision a developer makes, I'm going to work like this. Instead of get message, I'm going to use get messages, plural. And I'm going to specify how many messages that I want, up to 32. Let's say there are 32 messages in at least 32 messages in my queue. With get messages 32, I receive them all. Every one of the 32 messages is in one batch read into my application. And then the application developer needs to work on some multi-threaded application design. Because he has 32 messages, maybe he wants to process them parallel, and he starts up 32 threads to distribute the load inside the virtual machine. Does this make a difference in architecture? Yes, it influences your code. Does this influence the behavior of application? Yes. Potentially, this can go faster than this, but only when there are more than one message. So it depends on your workload. But it also influences your cost price, because look at this piece of code. This is a typical piece of code that you will see in a worker role, in a background process, while true. We will do something forever. And what we do is we read a message, and if the message is existing, cloud message is not null, then we will process the single message. Okay. What is this in terms of cost price? Well, because I'm doing a while loop, and because in that while loop I'm continuously doing a get message, for every get message that I do, I pay an amount of money. Very, very, very small amount of money. I pay $1 for every 10,000 messages that I read. For every 10,000 calls to the get message API, let's say like this. So if there are no messages in the queue, I also pay. For every iteration, there is a ticker plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. So if I let this run for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks in a year, and it doesn't process messages, I still pay for the iterations. For every get message, I need to pay. So what we need to do is some kind of throttling mechanism inside our application. We put a sleep in every iteration. And we make the time to sleep, we make this dynamic. If we see that there is no message, then we will wait for the next 10 seconds. And if after 10 seconds, again there is no message, we will wait for 1 minute, and then after 5 minutes, and maybe an hour, and so on. And at the moment I see messages coming in, then I will do the reverse. If I see there is a message, well, then the next time that I will read messages will not take me another hour, but again, a few seconds to really iterate through all the messages. If you're talking about the Azure queue, it's a polling mechanism. Yeah. It's a pure polling mechanism. And there is a while loop that will poll, is there something in the queue? If you're looking at Azure App Fabric Service Bus, we have a different way of working. In App Fabric Service Bus, there is a push mechanism. We can write a WCF service that does nothing and will be triggered by the system. So the system has something to tell, and it will just execute a call to your WCF service. So that's another way of working. In Azure Queues, we have this polling mechanism. In App Fabric Service Bus, we have a technology to do it the other way. It's a push mechanism. Yeah? But I'm just talking about Azure Queues here for that moment. It's a polling mechanism. But now let's have a look at operational costs. I've told you in the beginning, you're running in an operational cost model. You will see if I run 1 year, 24 hours a day, and I do every second 10 message calls, single message calls. This means I can have only one message at a time. And I do this every second, I do 10 message calls, get message. I do this for 1 year, 24 hours a day. Price for just reading the messages is $350. Okay, we can discuss, is this a lot of money, is this not a lot of money? It's not the moment now to discuss this, but you will see that if I do a get message call every minute for 24 hours a day, 1 year, you see, well, this is a multiplication by 600. Yeah? And then again, if I look here, I'm doing a message call, and I can only have one message in a minute at a time, maybe I can change this to the other version, get messages. Then I can read up to 32 messages. So if I read up to 32 messages, it only costs me one unit. Get messages singular, get message singular, or get messages plural, it costs me the same amount of money. Only in the second version, I can get up to 32 messages from the queuing system. So this means if I read 32 messages, then I can wait a little bit longer for the next iteration to look at my messages. Okay, can be complicated, but again, this is my message here. You're running in an operational expenses model. The developers are responsible for the end result of the price that you have to pay. So how you deal with that is make sure that you know this concept before you start programming, and this is why you're attending this presentation, of course. Second option is that you have some code review on your application. You have some people that are looking at the code to see these patterns, to see, well, if there is no sleep method inside that iteration loop, this is not a good idea. Yes, yes. So the question is, do we have tools to detect that? Mm-hmm. What you can do is, there is no real tool inside Visual Studio or inside Azure to do that. It's all based on APIs. You can always look at how many messages that are inside the queue. You can just know, well, for this queue, just tell me how many messages are inside that queue. No, it also costs you the same. So this is one part of the solution. You have to create a more complicated solution than that. But the best solution is to have this sleeping method that is exponential. You sleep for 1 minute, and you sleep for 10 minutes, and if you have a message, you go in the opposite direction. Yeah? Okay? So I see somebody's holding a sign with the number 10, means about 10 minutes. I'm almost at the end. Let's have a quick summary and maybe some more Q&A, no problem. Re-architecting is needed, yes. If you really want to make usage of all the cloud patterns, of all the functionality of Azure, yes, you should think about re-architecting. Yeah? Just moving an app to the cloud is easy. That is really easy. Your existing application, put it on a web role, it works. But you can have some issues. You need to do some design patterns and to really reach the benefits. Think about unit of scale. If you change something to one big architecture, you need to also change something else. It's not useful to just scale out your applications if you don't scale out your database or your disk I/O and so on. Stateless, but there are some solutions to work around that. Data partitioning, if you use Azure Storage. The SQL throttling, do the retry logic. Working with queues in an asynchronous architecture, think about your costs. So it depends on the cost depends on how good your code is. And do a code review to have a look at that. So this is the end. Maybe we have some more time for questions. Yes, go ahead.
Can you not subscribe to the queue?
Excuse me?
Your worker process not subscribe to the queue.
Your worker process will subscribe to the queue? Yes.
And can the queue not say, I have a message for you?
No. It's a polling mechanism. I discussed here the queues just to make the message clear that you're working in an operational cost and your code is influencing that. But in many applications, you will not need queues at all. If you just have a simple web application, you will not need a queuing system. You only need queuing system if you do background processing that are postponing your jobs into the worker role. But the worker role will always have this endless loop that pulls something from the queue, that will look into the queue, do you have something? And just looking at the queue, do you have something? And the answer is no, also costs you money. Yeah.
Suppose that you want to start a process at 900 hours.
That's a different approach. And then you will write in your code, you will write a scheduling mechanism. The while true doesn't cost you money. While true and every iteration, looking at the current date and comparing it to, let's say, midnight, this doesn't cost you money. But then you can say, well, if it's midnight, then I will start looking at my queue. This is a pattern that you can define. So just having a worker role with the endless iteration will only cost you the amount of hours that your CPU is running. And so also, if you're just in an endless loop checking the date against is it midnight or not, this is also costing you money because your processor is running. But at a certain moment in time, then you will start looking at your queues, and then you will pay for looking at the queues. Yeah? All right? See another question? No? Sorry. Go ahead.
Currently, you have the session state service to in load balance systems to keep track of sessions. Why isn't there an equivalent for the in the cloud?
There is, which is AppFabric Cache.
But which is different, so you have to modify your code.
No. If your code is just ASP.NET legacy code working with sessions, you can change your web config, the configuration of your web application, that you're using a storage environment for your sessions, and that storage environment is AppFabric caching. And then it happens automatically. You don't have to do anything. So your classic application with session variables, you just run it on Azure. But inside the web config, you say, well, for everything that I put in session, you must put it into the AppFabric cache. So the other instance can also read it from that AppFabric cache. So it's a central, it's memory. It's not disk, it's memory. It has a time to live. And you can say, well, for this variable that I want to store in the cache, it must be stored there for 1 hour, for 24 hours, unlimited. It's up to you. But it's a central place, and everybody can read it. There is an API to have access to that. But we make abstraction of that because we have a kind of state provider that is compliant with the ASP.NET state provider like you used to work now. So your application code doesn't have to change. Nothing, really nothing. It's only about changing the configuration, and it will work. Yeah. So this is an example of where you don't have to re-architect your application. Your existing code can still work. It's only about the plugin and changing some configuration to make use of the plugin to store the session state into that central system.